The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower you and put you in charge of your case. This is episode 18. I'm your host, attorney Noah Davis, broadcasting live from the studios of Clay 1180 AM in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington. Be sure to check out our website at www.knowyourrights.com. There's two R's there, www.knowyourrights.com, as we post the audio for each show, as well as follow-up information on each program, trying to develop as many resources for you as I can on that site. You can also email me during the show, after the show, anytime, prior to next week's show, at noah@knowyourrights.com. Finally, you can also, if you want to contact me or Clay Radio, you can visit clay1180.com, and you'll get more information about me, this show, and other programming on Clay 1180, your conversation station. For today's show, as I mentioned last week, we're continuing with our multi-part overview of employment law. In episodes 17 and 18, so the last 2 weeks, we covered choice of law provisions or choice of law between federal statutes and Washington state law. So federal statutes such as the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and then Washington state law, particularly the Washington law against discrimination. We also touched on the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the Washington state counterpart, the Washington Human Rights Commission, as well as some of the deadlines that you face as you move your case along. We discussed, in those past two episodes, we discussed wage and hour related disputes. We discussed retaliation, USERRA for employees called up to active duty service, and we also did an overview of sexual harassment claims. Although there are some significant, and I also discussed this last week too, there's some significant employment topics that we still need to cover, including discrimination based upon race, age, gender, sexual orientation, and disability. And there's also a common law claim that I had mentioned for wrongful termination and violation of public policy. So those are all areas that we still need to cover, we need to address in future shows if they're not addressed today. But now, having said that, I want to go back on and talk about a recent topic from episode 17. And the reason for this is I wanted to provide you, the listener, with some more detailed information on a very important resource for you that's available to you as you work your way through your employment dispute, and that is the Washington Human Rights Commission. Joining us on Know Your Rights from the Human Rights Commission is Laura Lindstrand. She's a policy analyst and attorney in her own right from the Washington State Human Rights Commission. Laura, welcome to Know Your Rights.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Laura, in episode 17, 2 weeks ago, I provided a short intro into what the EEOC and the Human Rights Commission do. I mainly focused on the difference between what I perceived as the EEOC's focus on enforcement of federal employment laws versus the Washington State Human Rights Commission being focused more on Washington state law and Washington state employers being in compliance with that law. But I should defer to the experts, and that's why I have you on the phone. So is that a fair way to describe the differences between the EEOC from like a foundational perspective, the EEOC and the Washington State Human Rights Commission, or how would you best describe?
You're correct. The EEOC definitely does enforce only federal law, specifically Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. We also enforce those laws, but we also enforce state law, which the EEOC cannot do. So Washington actually has one of the oldest civil rights statutes in the country, predating the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So we really pride ourselves on having one of the broadest civil rights laws in the nation that has the most protected categories of people. And we do enforce that state law to enable people then to go to state court or federal court. federal court with their claims.
So, and I did mention that either in episode 17 or episode 18 last week, that I believed, as an attorney that practices in this area, employment discrimination from time to time, or employment rights of both the employee or the employer, the cases are pretty clear that, and also the intent of the statute, the Washington law against discrimination, that Washington wants to stand apart and separate itself as saying, the purpose of the law, as its preamble says, is to eradicate discrimination in Washington state. So we kind of pride ourselves on having more protections than the federal statutory counterparts. And that seemed to be, you know, what you were saying just a moment ago, too.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And in addition to the language you just cited, there's also language in the statute that says the Washington law against discrimination is to be interpreted broadly. So when our state courts or even federal courts are interpreting our law and applying the law to various cases, they need to take that language into account, and the courts have actually done that. So we have an environment in Washington that is more employee worker friendly than many other states. So workers do have that advantage in Washington.
Can you talk about, and you did touch on this a moment ago, and that's those situations where there's this concurrent jurisdiction. Sometimes clients will come to me and they'll have filed a claim with the EEOC, but it ends up getting referred out to the Washington State Human Rights Commission, and it's sort of this concurrent jurisdiction, at least it seems like this concurrent jurisdiction idea to me. Can you talk a little bit more about why that happens or when it happens?
So in the past, the EEOC has had a backlog of cases. So when they have that backlog and they're not processing their cases as quickly as they would like to, they have often referred cases to the Human Rights Commission so we can process those cases a little more efficiently and quickly for the complaining parties and the responding parties. In addition, Washington law is a little more broad than federal law. It's actually a lot more broad. So under federal law, for example, under the Civil Rights Act, there have to be at least 15 employees in order for the EEOC to have jurisdiction. In Washington, in order for the Human Rights Commission to have jurisdiction, there only needs to be 8 employees. So we can have jurisdiction over and investigate those cases where there's only 8 employees.
And I mentioned to our listeners, I think this was in last week's show too, that even if the employer had less than 8 employees and it's outside the jurisdiction of the Human Rights Commission for the state of Washington, I still felt that because of the intent of the statute and because of the public policy of the state, that courts were still likely to enforce the statutes as a sort of in a common law basis against employers that had less than 8 employees. And I don't know if you've come across that situation or not, but I just want to make sure the employers know that they're not going to have a pass out there, depending on what type of activity they're engaged in, what type of unlawful activity they're engaged in, even if the Human Rights Commission didn't have jurisdiction.
That's absolutely true. In fact, when employers call me, I do the technical assistance for our agency, so employers around the state can call me and ask questions about compliance with the law, and that's exactly what I tell them, is that there are court decisions out there that are findings against companies that have fewer than 8 employees, and it is a common law theory of tort that the person is pursuing for wrongful termination or in one case I'm thinking of in particular, for sexual harassment. So even if employers have fewer than 8 employees, while it's not technically a violation of the law against discrimination, it could be still a violation of a common law theory of tort. So
we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay 1180 AM. Stay with us. We'll have Laura Lindstrand from the Human Rights Commission right after the break.
Right now, Cholula, one of America's favorite hot sauces, is teaming up with Jack in the Box for the Cholula Buttery Jack. With Cholula hot sauce, crispy jalapenos, and pepper jack cheese on a signature bun. Try it with Cholula fries. Jack! Can you cool it with the guitar, please?
Sorry, just got a little excited about the burger.
Try the Cholula Buttery Jack from Jack in the Box, part of the Buttery Jack family. Limited time only at participating restaurants.
Unbelievable.
I'm done.
Hi, I'm Noah from Know Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.knowyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@knowyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Welcome back to The Catch Show. Up next, we have Nico. Nico is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right. A group known especially for their sunspot sleeping, ball chasing, leg rubbing, couch purring, bed leaping, and of course, companionship.
Wonderful. And what breed would you say Nico is?
I'd have to go with a tabby-ish Persian kind of mix.
Tremendous cat.
I'd also like to point out her coat's wonderful mix of colors. Is it black, gray, gray-black, brown?
Somewhere in between.
Indeed.
You know, it's always special when we get to see a cat like this.
Just look how she struts.
It's like she owns the place.
And how she's so incredibly cute in her indifference to commands.
A strong-willed feline.
Ah, and see how she curls up and cuddles her person.
The pitch on her purring is simply perfect.
Nice one.
I know. Fantastic cat.
Fantastic indeed. But really the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Nico is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available to you. We're continuing our segments on employment law, and with us on the telephone is Laura Lindstrom from the Washington State Human Rights Commission. Laura, just before the break, I wanted to ask you a question, and I cut myself off a little bit, and that's the question that I wanted to put out there was whether when folks claim, when they file with the Washington State Human Rights Commission, whether there are some time limitations on their ability to file. Because if you think about the EOC, so the other avenue for making the complaints on under a federal statute, there's the 180-day limit that folks have to file, 180 days from the alleged activity that gives rise to their claim. Is there a condition or a limitation on folks under state law with the Washington State Human Rights Commission?
There certainly is. With employment cases that are filed with the Human Rights Commission, we do have a six-month statute of limitations. So say if somebody is fired or demoted, they have to file their case within 6 months of that adverse action. We also cover the areas of public employment, credit, and insurance. And the statute of limitations for those types of cases is also 6 months. We also deal with housing cases, housing discrimination cases, and in that situation, the statute of limitations is 1 year from the date of harm.
I see. With the EOC and some claims under, let's take, for example, the Civil Rights Act of 64, and it's going to be a race-based discrimination claim, the employee with the claim has to file within 180 days, again, with the EOC federal law, in order to avail themselves of that statute and have complied with the prerequisites for their claim. In order to file in federal court, they got to file with the EOC first, and they have that limited time frame to do so. On the state level, then, if there are these requirements that you file within 180 days, will that disallow a claim in state court later, or is the filing with the Washington State Human Rights Commission not a prerequisite for someone asserting their rights in court later?
It is not under state law. So we call that administrative exhaustion, and that means that in order to file, like you said, in federal court, you have to go through the EEOC administrative process first. But the same is not true if you're planning on filing your court case in state court. So you can either come through the Human Rights Commission, have us investigate your case. A lot of attorneys like us to do their discovery for them, and then they take the case on to court. Or a person can hire an attorney and go directly to state court with their claim.
Well, that's the comment you made just a moment ago was an interesting one, and it made me think of a positive and negative from an attorney point of view with a client that comes to me and they allege taking the race discrimination case or example that I'd given a moment ago. There's there's a client allegation that they've been discriminated based on race at work. They see a lawyer, me. I can encourage them to file with the Human Rights Commission, which we often do. And the benefit is, as you just said, that you'll work up the case, that you'll end up doing some discovery. You'll put the employer on notice. And I'll talk about this maybe in a moment too, the sort of protective status that you have when you file with the Human Rights Commission. But they file, you end up doing the discovery, helping us with the discovery. That's a real positive. But a negative is that I've seen some employers circle the wagons, end up using that process to help them in the future lawsuit that follows. And so they get like a head start in tailoring the defense of their suit to the defense of the investigation from the Human Rights Commission, which might not be as sort of direct or as much of an assault or fast-paced as a lawsuit might be. And maybe some thoughts on that.
It's true. It does go both ways. So the attorney for the plaintiff would definitely have an advantage in that a lot of the discovery is done, a lot of the documentation is done. They can do a public records request to get all of that information and have it in their file already to know exactly what the employer's defense is, what the witnesses have said, what the documentation shows. So they have a head start and can make a determination if they want to settle, what amount they want to settle for, and if they want to go to court at that point. But on the other hand, of course, then the employer does have a heads up as to what the claim is, what the witnesses are going to say. They have an opportunity to get their witnesses in line. Hopefully this doesn't happen a lot, but they have the opportunity, if they choose to do so, to lose documents. Like I said, I'm hoping it doesn't happen a lot, and I'm not aware of any specific instances in which I know of that it has happened, but it's a possibility. The same with witnesses. They have the opportunity to kind of groom their witnesses as to what to say. So it works both ways. There are advantages and disadvantages both parties.
What type of claims do the Human Rights Commission cover? And you touched on this just briefly, but it's broader than just employment-based claims only.
Yes, it is much broader. So we deal with employment, public accommodation. So if you were to go to a restaurant, a movie theater, a mall, something along those lines, and feel like you were discriminated against based on a protected class, you could file a claim with us. Credit and insurance. So if you believe that you were denied credit or were denied an insurance policy because of a protected class, you could file a claim with us. And the other big area that we cover is housing. So if you feel like you were not given a rental apartment because of your race, or you were kicked out of an apartment because you had a child, then you could file a claim with us.
Let's talk about some areas that the Human Rights Commission would not cover. And the two that come to mind would be a situation where people are on the street and one person harasses another and uses discriminatory, like racially charged language. That wouldn't fall under the purview of the Human Rights Commission, right?
It would not. It doesn't fall into one of our specific areas. It's not a place of public accommodation because there's no business. So in order, if that were to happen in a business, for example, in a store, that might be one situation. But just out on the street or neighbors having a dispute or something along those lines where there's no housing provider or there's no business or there's no employer involved, we wouldn't cover those areas. I also mentioned that you have to have 8 employees in order to be covered by the jurisdiction of the Human Rights Commission. We don't take cases where the employer is a federal entity. So if you went to the post office and couldn't get your wheelchair through the door of the post office, that would have to be a federal claim. We don't take cases against tribal entities. So if you went to a tribal casino and were playing and got kicked out and thought it was because of your race, we would not be able to take that type of case. We don't deal with things like jails, prison, court decisions, DSHS issues, such as the issuance of public benefits, L&I issues, wages, hours, working conditions, workplace safety, that sort of thing. We don't deal with those issues either.
Your one of the examples you gave, which was the wheelchair example, maybe if you're an employer at the post office or employee and you asked for a wheelchair and you weren't accommodated or you had some other disability and you asked for an accommodation, you weren't provided that. It reminded me of a case that I did out of Florida that was a cruise ship. And since we have a lot of cruise ships that make Washington home, that dock here, I can see those situations coming up. And in my case, it was an elderly, like 98-year-old man that had requested a wheelchair, and it wasn't there when he was debarking or disembarking, and he fell and hurt himself pretty severely, and he was hospitalized for a long time. That in that case, I think we filed with the EEOC first before we filed suit, but that's a case that we could bring with the Human Rights Commission too, right?
Yes. So if you're a passenger on a cruise ship, you would be in a place of public accommodation. And as a place of public accommodation, the cruise ship is obligated to reasonably accommodate you. So if you need special assistance or a wheelchair or some sort of other special equipment while you're on the cruise and they fail to provide it to you, then you could definitely file a claim with the Human Rights Commission.
What are the most common types of claims that are filed with the Human Rights Commission?
So the protected classes we cover are race, color, creed, national origin, age over 40, sex, including pregnancy, disability, use of a dog guide or a service animal, veteran and military status, sexual orientation, gender identity, and marital status. And in addition, housing covers family with children, and public accommodation covers breastfeeding mothers. So out of those protected classes, the biggest protected class that we deal with is the disability cases. Mm. So it could be a harassment case, it could be a different treatment case, or it could be a failure to reasonably accommodate somebody with a disability.
You know, those are tough cases both ways for the employer and the employee, because on the one hand, you have an employee who is suffering a disability, and it might be a permanent disability, it might be a permanent partial, it could be a temporary disability. Obviously, it depends on the context and the situation. And you have an employer who, depending on the size, might have some difficulty making that accommodation or knowing, trying to figure out what the right accommodation is. How can they continue to employ this person and continue to provide the services that they do as far as the employer goes, whatever type of work they're engaged in. So I can see those just from the attorney point of view, and then also maybe from the employer point of view, the mechanics of that can be really difficult.
It is really difficult, and a lot of employers don't know the process. They don't realize that they need to engage in an interactive process with the employee when, in Washington, it's as simple as you know the employee has a disability and they're having some work performance issues that could be impacted by that disability. It's actually the employer's job to put those things together and approach the employee in that situation to determine whether or not that employee needs a reasonable accommodation. So in Washington, the law is so favoring that person with a disability that they don't even have to come out and say, I need a reasonable accommodation. So that puts quite a burden on the employer, and then the employer has to start that reasonable accommodation interactive process with the employee to determine what might be out there that could help the employee do their job, or is there another job that is open that the employee can do? There's a whole checklist of things that the employer needs to go through in order to try and accommodate that person before they can start thinking about a disability separation scenario.
Right, and sometimes that means engaging the person that's under the disability, engaging their medical professional, whomever care they're under, trying to reach out and talk to that person to find out what's medically necessary to accommodate them. I've seen that sometimes in cases too.
Exactly, and that is one of the only times that an employer can legally obtain medical information about their employee.
So let's change gears just briefly, and that's to sexual harassment. Are you seeing, obviously nationally, there's this Me Too, hashtag Me Too movement, and that's making awareness a huge issue across the U.S., awareness of sexual harassment in a wide variety of forums, most notably, it would seem, the employment context. Are you seeing a bump or increase in sexual harassment-based claims, and would you attribute that to the Me Too movement or related to that?
We are seeing an increase in sexual harassment cases. So across the board, we're actually seeing a decrease in the number of cases we're dealing with. We're not exactly sure why that is, but generally we have about 700 to 800 open cases at any given time. Right now our inventory is actually as low as about 450 to 500 cases. So we're seeing a really steep drop in the number of cases we have, We're not sure, but we think that might be due to the political climate. People are afraid to file, except in the area of sexual harassment. And the only thing I can think of is that it is attributable to the Me Too movement, that women are now finding a voice and having the courage to open up and file those types of claims because they know other people have gone through it. They've awareness is increasing about the problem. So unfortunately, it is a real problem out there. I've because of the increased number of cases, we're also seeing really egregious cases. One case came across my desk just a couple days ago where an immigrant woman in a pretty low-paying, unskilled labor type of job was repeatedly raped by her supervisor.
Wow, that's terrible.
And unfortunately, she belongs to a community of people who are not very supportive of her. Mm. So the fact that this immigrant woman who is not getting a lot of support from her community came forward with this is just amazing, and her story is horrific. And we're seeing a lot of pretty egregious sexual harassment situations that involve inappropriate touching, sexual contact, not just words and jokes and comments, but actual harassment of a physical nature. So
it
happens, and it's bad.
It's tough in the current political climate and the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions wanting to dial back the prosecution of or enforcement of civil rights era laws. It seems that that's the position that's being pushed through by the current administration. But people and listeners out there need to realize that that's not going to affect your job and what the Human Rights Commission does for folks here. You're still going to go to bat for them as much, if not more, than you ever did before in order to protect them and help them with the enforce the laws of the state of Washington, help them with their rights.
That's absolutely right. And we did have some confusion with people when the administration started dialing back the protections for sexual orientation and gender identity. Some people called us with concerns about what that would mean for them. And I assured them, Washington State does not follow federal law. We will continue to follow Washington State law, which has a broad range of categories of people that we protect. And we will continue to do so no matter what the federal government does. So we will definitely continue to investigate these cases no matter what happens on a federal level.
Can you take us through the process for folks that need to file or want to file a complaint with the Human Rights Commission, and can they do so online through the website?
Yeah, they can either call us and we can send them an intake questionnaire, or they can go on our website, which is www.hum.wa.gov, and they can click the button which says that they want to file a complaint, and they can go to our online complaint form. They can either fill it out online or they can print it out and fill it out by hand. They do need to actually physically sign it. We do not accept computerized signatures, so they need to at some point print it out and sign it. But once they sign it, date it, and send it back to us, the day we get that is the date that their complaint is filed. And that complaint is then assigned to our intake department to make sure we have jurisdiction and make sure it's an area and an issue that we can look into.
During the investigation from the Human Rights Commission, is there, under state law, are the claims told? So, like, let's say someone brings their claim within 6 months, but let's say the investigation takes like 2 years or something, and not that it's going to take that long, but during that time, is there a potential to toll the statute of limitations for the complainant's claims?
I'm glad you brought that up. There is no tolling of the statute of limitations. So the clock keeps ticking while the case is being investigated by the Human Rights Commission. And it actually can take a while for us to do it because our budget was cut quite severely during the recession, and we've never recovered. So when I started at the Human Rights Commission about 15 years ago, we had over 60 employees all over the state of Washington. We are now down to 25 employees.
Wow, that's a big cut.
It is. So what that means, of course, is unfortunately the time it takes for us to investigate cases has grown longer. So that means both the person, the complaining party, and their attorney need to keep an eye on the state statute of limitations to make sure that isn't getting close while their claim is being investigated.
And if it is, I guess they could contact the HRC and say, hey, we're going to pull out of this process or we're going to go ahead and file.
Absolutely. And that is what I would recommend. If it's getting close to your statute of limitations for filing in state court and you want to file in state court, then you can withdraw your claim and just go ahead and file.
I guess that's one way the Trump administration also can affect the state administrative agency that investigates cases of discrimination, and that's by not sharing federal dollars that might have been available in past years. So I didn't think about that way as a way of controlling the state budget, but that's a possibility, I guess.
It's definitely a possibility. We have contracts with both the EEOC and Housing and Urban Development to investigate both employment and housing cases on the behalf of both of those agencies, and they do pay us for those investigations. So if their budgets start being cut in their civil rights departments, then eventually that's going to trickle down and hurt us.
So with the limited resources that you now have from a staff perspective, particularly, and then also just a dollar perspective, how does the HRC pick the cases? I mean, are you just looking for sort of slam dunk, clear-cut cases? The ones that are a little bit less black and white are going to be ones that you're just not going to be able to put a lot of time or resources into, I would guess.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. One of the things that we unfortunately have had to do is cut back on our training program. Whenever anybody wanted training, we used to be able to go out and do trainings for businesses and unions and groups of people, and we can't do that anymore. We actually have to look for very large audiences where our reach is going to go very far to invest in that training. But the other thing that we're doing is exactly what you said, and that is we're triaging the cases to determine which cases actually have a factual dispute that needs to be investigated. And we will put more resources into investigating those cases, and which are the cases that, if you just look at what the complaining party is saying, it's almost like a summary judgment standard. If you look at what they're saying and what they're, the facts that they're presenting are not a violation of non-discrimination law, then that is going to be a pretty short, efficient investigation. So we will put more resources into the cases that have a factual dispute that we need to get in there and find out exactly what's going on. And then we also emphasize cases of sexual harassment where there's egregious sexual harassment going on, and cases in which there is a disability that is the person's life expectancy is not very long. So we will invest our resources into those cases to make sure that that person has closure.
And just because the Human Rights Commission ultimately doesn't move forward or take action on a complaint, same thing goes with the EEOC and you get that right to sue letter, it doesn't mean you're not weighing in on the merits of the case. You're just saying, based on what's been presented, the investigation that we were able to do, we're just not able to find a clear-cut case of a violation of Washington law, and then the person's free to sue at that point, right?
They're definitely free to sue. I mean, it depends on what facts we can find, and of course, it's often very difficult to prove discrimination occurred. As you talked about in one of your previous shows, the employer can always find a reason for doing what they did, and that's, in technical terms, called a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. So they can always dig up something on you.
We like to call it pretext, but I hear it from the employer side, non-discriminatory reason, yep.
Yeah, and then so to show that that is pretext, it can be very difficult for the plaintiff to do that, especially if there's any kind of evidence, documentation, write-up, discipline to back up the employer's defense. So it can be very difficult to prove these cases, like in a sexual harassment case. Often this is done behind closed doors. Nobody sees it. There's no witnesses. The person is embarrassed to tell anybody. So there's often not, an excited utterance that can be used as a witness testimony or anything like that. So it doesn't, just because we find that there's not enough evidence to show discrimination occurred does not mean that it did not occur. It does not mean that it didn't happen. It just means that legally the evidence is not strong enough to show it happened. But someone could file a case, get it before a jury, and a jury has a lot more leeway to make decisions based on credibility issues or whether they believe somebody. So it's always worth it. Or to try and get their attorney to come to a settlement. Many employers would rather settle the case than to go through the court system.
Yeah, and if you do find sort of an egregious violation, what action does the Human Rights Commission take?
So if we find enough evidence to show discrimination occurred, and that standard is by a preponderance of the evidence, then we will recommend a reasonable cause finding. That's reasonable cause to believe discrimination occurred. Our statute dictates that we try and settle that case before we go any further with it. So if we've got a lot of strong evidence there and it looks like it's leaning toward a reasonable cause finding, we will approach the parties and try and come to a settlement agreement between the parties. If that fails, then we refer the case to our assistant attorney general, who then will prosecute that case in an administrative hearing. So those cases will actually go to a court-like setting to be adjudicated.
Well, Laura, I really appreciate this time that you've spent with us explaining our listeners about the process. Can you give that website again for the Human Rights Commission?
Absolutely. It's www.hum.wa.gov.
Okay, Laura Lindstrom from the Human Rights Commission, thank you so much for joining us on Know Your Rights. This has been very educational and helpful, and I'll be sure to update the website to provide information for the Human Rights Commission. And maybe, if you let me, I'll put some contact information on there for you too.
That would be great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Have a good afternoon. Listeners, we'll be right back after this break. And I've got an exciting, exciting topic, a news break item that's of local interest to us. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Jack Box, and for the millions of Americans living with a taco obsession, my new $3 taco deal with three of the tacos you love and a small drink can offer relief. Relief for people like Janet, who changed her name to Mrs. Taco.
Actually, it's Ms. Taco.
Or Dave, who celebrates Taco Tuesday every day.
Taco Tuesday!
No, Dave, it's Sunday, and it's your wife's birthday.
Oh, I should get her some tacos!
So please, try my $3 taco deal today. New at Jack in the Box. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. Small fountain drink.
Hi, I'm Noah from Know Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.knowyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@knowyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Some statistics are surprising, some are unbelievable, and some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%, and that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to educating you on your legal rights and resources that are available to you. Make sure you check out our website at www.knowyourrights.com. You can also email me, noah@knowyourrights.com. We're going to throw you a little curveball here. We're going to take a detour from our employment law debate or section or informational session. And that's to bring you really a breaking story that's of local importance. Taking the headlines locally here in Pierce County has been the revelation that a nurse at a local hospital, the Puyallup MultiCare Good Samaritan, has been arrested for stealing drugs. She was on her way into Canada. I mean, it wasn't like she was escaping into Canada. I think they had a pre-planned vacation. But crossing the border, she was arrested And the allegation was that she had been stealing drugs from the hospital. She's also, it's alleged, that she's infected patients, at least two, it seems, from the records that are coming out as the story develops, with hepatitis C. For those of you that are in the medical field or in the know about this, hepatitis C is a virus in the blood that attacks your liver, and it can be fatal. It absolutely can kill you if left untreated, so it's a pretty dangerous virus. But with an early diagnosis, you can end up taking some medication, and in most cases, it can be cured. But because this is a really developing story, and because so many people might be infected or want to know more information about this, we're going to take this detour, and I'm going to bring on with me on the show Jackson Paulke from the Connolly & Associates Law Firm, who's representing at least one of the patients that contracted hepatitis C. Jackson, welcome to Know Your Rights.
Hey, Noah. Glad to be here.
So, Jackson, can you update, and I know the story is developing from your end, too, and you might not have answers to all these questions, but can you update our listeners as to what we know about this situation, the hospital situation, your client, this nurse, the people that might have contracted or been exposed as hepatitis C?
Yeah, of course. I'll kind of give the broad picture. So, generally, you know, folks have gone to the Good Samaritan Puyallup and to the emergency room, and they've been exposed to hepatitis C. Now, the range is sort of from August until late March is what we're told from MultiCare in the letter they sent out recently. But it's obviously a serious issue, and we now have four clients who have sadly contracted hepatitis C from their visit at the hospital. And the exact mechanism is not quite known. What is known is that these folks went into the emergency room without hepatitis C, and they left with it. Now, at the same time, you kind of hinted at this. Nurse Weberg has had allegations and was arrested at the border of Canada for a planned trip, and she's stated that she's diverted drugs. But, you know, and I can't comment on the criminal allegations just because it's not, you know, my way in traffic. I'm not a criminal attorney. We're not suing her. We're suing MultiCare, the Good Samaritan Hospital, for exposing these folks to hepatitis C. Earlier today, I was just watching the press conference by Nurse Weaver.
Yeah, I saw that too. Watch that as well. Yep.
Yeah, and so it's a lot of news is breaking and things like that. And one of her clients was told that he didn't have Nurse Weberg as his nurse. So, you know, there's a lot of thought in the, you know, the investigation is ongoing as to how these folks got it from Good Samaritan Hospital.
Right. Well, so the reports that I was reading were saying that at least two patients had contracted hepatitis C, and that the hospital or the investigation that had been done had traced that back to the hospital, but they were still figuring out if it matched Nurse Weber's hepatitis C positive test as well, but they're not sure if the source was Nurse Weber or not. And that's still a developing story, part of this.
That's right. That's totally right. On April 27, 2018, the Good Samaritan sent out a letter to folks who are exposed, potentially exposed to hepatitis C when they're in the emergency room. And at that time, they said that two people had tested positive for hepatitis C. You know, now it's kind of unclear exactly what the number is. We have four clients, in addition to those two and that are mentioned in the letter, who do have hepatitis C, so it's at least six. And
oh, wow.
The letter says, go get tested, and if you do get a letter, you certainly should. So,
I mean, there's a risk.
Yeah,
there's a risk here that this could be a potential epidemic. I mean, the numbers that they sent of folks that might have been exposed over this 8-month period is something like 2,600 people, and you already have six. And there's a lot of people that don't know. I mean, they've been walking around for 8 months. They might be positive with Hep C. And they might be having sexual relations, as people normally do. They're sharing toothbrushes, maybe. They're doing other things. Maybe someone is sharing a needle, but they're sharing intravenous fluids, I guess. And that's one way that it seems that you can contract the hepatitis C. So, there's a real danger here.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, it's just staggering. And that's why hospitals focus so hard and have such a big duty to ensure that they're not putting people at risk for these diseases so they can get spread so fast and so easily. So that's also another shocking thing, just, how exactly could the hospital let this happen? And the fact that you have this big lag period, from August until now, when they're looking at the exposure, it's incredibly concerning. And also some folks who get tested who were exposed recently might have to get retested because there's a latency period with hepatitis C, which means that you might take a test, and if you just were recently exposed and you did contract it, there's an incubation time where it doesn't show up. And so you're going to have to take another test, perhaps 6 months later. So it's important to follow up immediately and to be really on ball about your testing and follow up as well.
Well, it seems like the hospital is doing some damage control on the one hand. They're trying to do public relations, and maybe that's part of the damage control, on the other hand. And then they also have a duty to these patients to inform those that may have contracted hepatitis C from a worker at the hospital. And it seems like these links are all coming back to either Nurse Weber or the ER or someone else there. And I saw that there was a website that people could check. And I'll just go ahead and read that website. And this is for MultiCare to check and see if your name's one of those 2,600 that have been identified as potentially at risk. And I haven't visited this website, so I'll just give that disclaimer. And I don't know what type of information it's going to provide, but it's www.multicare.org / I don't know if that's a / or / safety-alert. And then another /. So multicare.org, but check that out and see if you're on the list if you visited that hospital in the from August 4th to March 23rd, that 8 month period. Let's talk about what the hospital did or didn't do. So they said they did this month long investigation. I mean, that's a long time to be doing an investigation and not telling people.
Yeah, and it's concerning for a lot of reasons. So we have from the letter that they say, we recently discovered that during this eight-month period, an employee may have exposed at least two patients. But, what we really need to focus on is not only like when the hospital knew, but when they should have known. You can't exactly have your head in the sand and say, well, you can't hold me accountable because I had no idea. They have a duty to monitor, check, supervise, and vet all employees who are in the emergency room, anywhere dealing with contagious diseases alongside with dispensing, drugs and things like that to patients.
Yeah, well, that caused me the biggest concern too, because you're a patient going in looking for help, trying to get well, and the hospital is endangering you, and it's already a place. It already is a place that's becoming a leading cause of death in its own right. And now you add this. I mean, I don't understand what's going on over there.
Yeah, that's. That's how I feel, and that's how, our clients feel. They want answers, and they deserve answers. They went to the hospital, as you mentioned, and well, you always need to go to the hospital. It's not for fun. It's to get better.
Yeah.
And they were exposed to a really serious risk, and having hepatitis C is, it's a really big problem. You need to get it taken care of as soon as possible.
Well, and the hospital says it's being transparent. That was the press release or the statement that they made. But I haven't seen the transparency yet. And I don't know if you have, if they're providing you the information, the answers that you want, but this is already taking too much time for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think I generally have what you have. I've watched the press releases and looked at their safety alert letter, which just says, we recently discovered. Well, I'd like to know how they discovered it. And why it wasn't discovered sooner. They have protocols in place to make sure that hepatitis C and other contagious diseases aren't spread, that drugs aren't diverted. I mean, these are certainly things that they're aware of and have a duty to make sure aren't abused. And obviously, that didn't happen. I mean, 2,600 people, that's not, a small chunk of people. That's huge.
It's a lot of people.
And that's just the folks that were exposed to it directly.
Right. It's not everyone that was at the hospital. There's a lot more, and potentially, and I don't know the answer to this, and you probably won't either, but it could be broader than the 2,600, depending on where Nurse Weber or the source of the Hep C, where it spread or where it was. I mean, it could be broader than the ER. Who knows at this stage?
Yeah, and that's, again, why we want as much transparency from the hospital as possible and to get these answers. If it's you know, whatever it is we want to know.
Look, and Nurse Weber presented well. She cried during her press statement. She had her lawyers there. She had this prepared statement. And she says that she's admitted to diverting some drugs for her own personal use, but she says she hasn't done anything unlawful. And I know you said you don't necessarily want to comment on the criminality of things, and I'm not necessarily asking you that question, but diversion to me is taking unlawfully these drugs that were meant for patients, and you're using them for your own personal use, which she's admitting apparently to investigators that that's what she did. But we keep saying diversion, but she really stole these drugs apparently for her personal use.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's what I heard too from Nurse Weber during that conference. And, you know, I'm not going to comment on the criminal allegation just because that's not really our, you know, that doesn't really concern so much as that the hospital exposed these folks. But either way, it's incredibly concerning to hear her say that. And also one of our other attorneys said that, you know, Nurse Weber is not the only one who diverts drugs. And, you know, that's alarming.
Yeah,
and it just shows that the hospital needs to be honest. You know, it's exposing folks to a serious risk.
Yeah, we might have a systemic type problem. And Nurse Weber, during her PR release today or yesterday, whenever that took place, when she says that she didn't intentionally infect anyone with Hep C and that she diverted these, I don't think she mentioned at that a press conference, maybe she did, that she diverted but didn't do anything unlawful regarding the drugs. But she said that she passed drug tests. Well, the hospital's saying that too, that they drug test at the beginning, but that's not good enough. If someone's been working there for 8+ months and you're not regularly testing them, or just looking at your inventory, just look at your drug inventory and let's keep track of where these drugs are going and make sure that we can find out what's being used on who, when, so that people can't run off with these drugs. And then obviously, we still got to find out why or how she was passing on this Hep C a virus that she had to other folks if she ends up being the source.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, of course, they have these drug tests, but if, you know, they appear potentially not to be working, if she says, like, yeah, I was having those issues. But another thing, you know, she said that she's really struggling, and the hospital also has a duty to make sure that employees aren't like decompensating in front of their eyes and can't do their job safely. They have a job to make sure that the employees they have dealing directly with the patients are able to do so, and you know, aren't, you know, unable to do their job. And it seems like that just wasn't done.
Well, Jackson, how can folks get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, they can just call into our firm, Connolly Law Offices, and ask for Amanda Searle or myself, Jackson Polky. Our number is 253-593-5100.
Maybe say that one more time.
Yep. The number is 253-593-5100 and Connolly Law Offices.
All right. Well, Jackson, thank you so much for joining us on Know Your Rights and sharing the information that you have about this breaking story.
Yeah. Thanks for your concern about the serious issue, Noah. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care. And that's going to do it for us on this episode of Know Your Rights. Thanks for spending the last hour with us. Thanks for supporting Clay 1180 AM, your conversation station. And we'll definitely see you next week. Stay safe out there.